Chase for Business and iHeart bring you a new podcast series called The Unshakeables. This one-of-a-kind series will shine the spotlight on small business owners like you, who faced a do-or-die moment that ultimately made their business what it is today. Learn more at chase.com/business/podcast. Chase, make more of what's yours. Chase mobile app is available for select mobile devices. Message and data rates may apply. JP Morgan Chase, NA member FDIC, 2024, JP Morgan Chase & Co.
The most innovative companies are going further with T-Mobile for Business. Tractor Supply trusts 5G solutions from T-Mobile. Together, they're connecting over 2,200 stores with 5G business internet and powering AI so team members can match shoppers with the products they need faster. This is enriching customer experience. This is Tractor Supply with T-Mobile for Business. Take your business further at T-Mobile.com/now.
Before AI can help your business predict demand, accelerate growth, inform decisions, automate tasks, reveal insights, generate content, you have to trust it. Introducing Watson X Governance, helping you govern any AI as data, models, and policies change so you can scale it responsibly. Let's create AI that begins with trust with Watson X Governance. Learn more at ibm.com/governance. IBM, let's create.
Pushkin. This is Talk Easy. I'm Sam Fragoso. Welcome to the show. Today, I'm joined by actor and director Michael Shannon. Over the past decade, Shannon has transformed into one of our finest working American actors. He's collaborated with auteurs like Jeff Nichols on Mud and Midnight Special, Tom Ford for Nocturnal Animals, Guillermo del Toro for The Shape of Water. Then, of course, you have this recurring run as supervillain General Zod in films like Man of Steel, Batman v Superman, and most recently, The Flash. But regardless of the size or scope of the project, Shannon seems to alternate between towering and taciturn, hulking and tender. And that seems to be true in each of Shannon's performances, including his latest work as notorious country singer George Jones, playing opposite Jessica Chastain as Tammy Wynette. Here's a clip from the aptly titled limited series, George and Tammy.
Here's what I'll say. There's something about having a number one hit. It does something to a person.
Put your hands together for George Jones!
You live in a fast world.
Fast is the only speed I know.
Miss Tammy Wynette.
Mm-hmm.
Will you make me an honest man?
You make me an honest woman?
You bet.
You can't bear happiness.
Nobody wants me happy.
I do.
That was from the limited series, George and Tammy, now available to stream on Hulu or through the Showtime app. As per usual, Shannon is excellent as the wayward yet electrifying country star. Shannon himself has actually been making music with his band Corporal since 2007. We talk a little bit about both the show and his songwriting at the top of this conversation. We also dive into his upbringing in Lexington, Kentucky, his early theater work in Chicago alongside playwright and actor Tracy Letts, his long-standing collaborations with Jeff Nichols and Jessica Chastain, the pre-apocalyptic prescience of Take Shelter, and of course, his directorial debut, which recently premiered at this year's Tribeca Film Festival. This is Michael Shannon.
Thank you.
Michael Shannon.
Yep.
Pleasure to meet you.
Thanks. Nice to meet you too, Sam.
How you doing?
I'm steady as she goes, brother. I went for a long walk on the beach this morning, which I like, and yeah, I'm staying out in Santa Monica, so I like being by the ocean.
Was anything top of mind on the beach?
I got a couple of songs I've been working on in my head, and I was trying to, I can't finish the lyrics, so I keep trying to come up with something impressive to say, but sometimes there just isn't.
Well, if you need me to take a look and see if I can come up with anything.
You want to co-write the lyrics for me?
I won't take credit for it. Yeah. You know, there's a writer's strike right now, so I can't.
Are you experienced at writing lyrics or songs?
I wouldn't say good ones.
Well, that's the thing is, if you're going to write a song, it better be, because there's so many crappy songs out there. The world doesn't need more crappy songs.
In terms of a good song, we ought to start with George and Tammy.
Oh, okay. Yeah, those are amazing songs.
Considering how varied your career is, there are a bunch of places to start. But if there's one through line in your work, you said that it's that the people I play are all in their own private shitbox.
I said that.
They're all suffering as much as any other human being on Earth. So of all the shitboxes and all the towns and all the world, what about this country star George Jones drew you in?
You know, it's interesting. The show wasn't my idea. My friend Jessica called me up, and she was the one who had a hunch that I should consider doing it. I was pretty reluctant at first, just because I didn't feel qualified. I didn't know all that much about him, and I'm more of a jazz guy, you know.
Is that why you didn't feel qualified?
Well, yeah, I mean, I figured there'd be other people that would be have more history with it or be more familiar with it going into it, you know. But she convinced me, she talked me into it, and then I just started reading about him. I read his autobiography and started watching his performances, clips on, you know, YouTube, stuff anybody could do, really. He just seemed like a really complicated person. And I was very moved when I read his autobiography about how he grew up and his childhood experiences with his family, with his father, how he would sing for his father, and how it created this, I think, dynamic that played throughout his life where I think he both loved and hated singing, you know? I mean, I think he loved singing purely as an art form, but he hated the whole dynamic of performing for other people because other people wanted him to or were expecting him to, or, you know, just because of being forced to sing for his father because he was afraid, you know, and I think that never really went away. And that's why it led to, you know, all those years later, the moniker, you know, No Show Jones, when he wouldn't show up for concerts. I just found that fascinating. Like, no matter how screwed up you are, even if you're loaded or whatever, someone who would just not show up for a concert. I haven't really heard of another artist doing that. So I was very, that drew me in.
You first worked with Jessica Chastain back on Take Shelter.
Yep.
In 2011. That's directed by the great Jeff Nichols.
Yeah.
When she calls you to convince you to do that, what does that sound like? You don't seem like someone that could be persuaded very easily.
We're old buddies. I mean, that film was a big deal for both of us, and it was the beginning of a pretty deep kind of connection and friendship. And back when I was doing Take Shelter, Jessica became aware that I sang and that I did music. I had a band, and, you know, when she was talking to me about this, she said, this is such a wonderful opportunity for you to incorporate singing into a show. I'm like, yeah, but, you know, I don't sing like George Jones. But I don't know. I think it was mostly just her belief, you know, the fact that she believed in me. And I also didn't want to leave her high and dry, you know. A lot of times I'm pretty susceptible, actually, if people say, I just really need you to do this. And I say, well, if you really need me, I guess I should do it.
That was exactly what we said when we asked you to come on the show. Like George and Tammy, both you and Jessica did not take the easy route getting into this business. As you've said, we both had some hard knocks that we came from, and so we could identify with that aspect of George and Tammy's lives.
Mm-hmm.
I want to understand that time a little bit for you, because you grew up in Lexington, Kentucky,
mm-hmm.
where your parents split up early and then promptly jump into new marriages. I think they were each married 5 times.
Yeah, they both were. They were each other's third marriage.
After spending the first 13 years with your mother, you move up to Evanston with your father in 1987. But you come back to Lexington, as I understand it, in your junior year.
True.
Where you get cast as Dr. Chumley in the Pulitzer Prize-winning play, Harvey.
I didn't know it won the Pulitzer.
It sure did.
Uh-huh.
It actually beat out, I think, the Glass Menagerie that year. In that period, which seemed to be marked by tumult and turmoil, what did that experience, that first real experience, do for you on stage?
Oh, dear. I don't know. I mean, the thing about it is the play Harvey was about as far away as from my actual life experience at the time as you could possibly get.
What do you mean by that?
Well, it's just kind of a comedy, really. At the end of the day, it seemed like it anyway. I had this thing in high school, they would tap me to play the older fellas. I don't know, when I was younger, people always seemed to think, they'd tell me, oh, you got an old soul, and you seem older than you are or something. So I was playing this older fella in this kind of madcap comedy situation. That was nice, to get away from, whatever my actual life experience was at the time, to have something that was so different as it could possibly be.
What did your mother think of your performance?
I don't think she came. If she did, I don't remember.
But your classmates thought, wow, this guy's pretty good at this.
Yeah, I guess. I mean, it was Henry Clay High School, home of the Blue Devils. It's not where any careers are born, really. But I don't know. The play in general, as I recall, and keep in mind, this is 33 years ago, so I don't remember it like yesterday. It was fun. Harvey's fun, and we made people laugh, and it just made everybody a little happier, I guess.
I bring the play up because you've said many times over that doing this production made you realize that acting might be more than just something I'm going to do to kill the time and ease the pain.
Oh, did I say that? Holy shit, man. Whew. Damn. You got to watch what you say.
You got to watch what you say because it's not true or because it is?
Oh, I don't know. That just sounds awfully melodramatic. I don't know whether it's true or not. But there's something crystallized when I was doing it. But it wasn't really until I got back to Chicago that I really dove deeply into the dark arts.
I want to talk about that time because in between canvassing on behalf of an environmental group and working at the Fishbowl,
oh man,
which sat on the corner of Dempster and Chicago Avenue,
yep,
you did a whole lot of non-equity theater. When you drop back into that period, performing in the basement of Cafe Voltaire,
mm-hmm.
what did that look like?
With hindsight, everything can look a lot prettier, I guess, than maybe it was at the time. I mean, I remember those days as being pretty carefree, like I wasn't hooked up to a career or anything. I was just picking up plays and reading them and thinking, oh man, this would be amazing. And then you go do it, and you can do it kind of however you want to do it, if you're not getting paid to do it, or if not that many people are coming to see it, then you have a lot of freedom. So, yeah, that basement at Cafe Voltaire, I did some really crazy stuff down there.
It was an Edward Albee play?
Well, yeah, there was a zoo story. I did that with my buddy Dan Meyer. I did something down there once all by myself. So David Mamet wrote this play called The Water Engine. It was like a radio play, but it had a prologue, a brief play before it called Mr. Happiness, which was like an advice column. Somebody would send in a letter and this fellow on the radio would give advice about it. And I did that prologue by myself. I didn't even have anybody else, no stage manager, no nothing, but just me. I presented it as if I was like some homeless guy who was like going through somebody's mail or something, or maybe even just making it up, like reading off a food wrapper or something, pretending like, and I just got like some garbage and I threw it around the stage and some Christmas lights and hung them on the wall. And then the people would come downstairs and whoever managed to show up, again, it wasn't like a international sensation or anything. And I would just do it. It was weird. It was like the lights didn't even go down or they didn't come up. I didn't even do a curtain call. There was no bowing or applause. I just did it. And then I would get up and leave.
How much of that earlier work that was for an audience of anywhere from 2 to 20 people, How much of that was you getting what was inside of you out?
Yeah, it's hard to know sometimes which way things, if they're coming or going, in or out, you know?
That's a good lyric for a song.
Damn. But I ain't got a pencil. How am I ever going to remember it? Oh, you got to send it to me.
It's almost like this whole thing is recorded.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, we got your back.
Cool. You know, I never felt like I was solving my deep, dark problems or anything. It was more something like that. What I'm describing is creative, you know, it's an act of creativity. And that, you know, I think it's basically just a way of organizing your subconsciousness, and like, it's like this frenetic cosmos, you know, that things are just ricocheting all around, all your thoughts and quandaries about things. And it's a way of slowing that down and presenting a version of something that's on your mind. I don't know if it necessarily means you're going to be enlightened afterwards, but it's soothing somehow, I guess.
I know a lot of actors talk about acting being therapeutic or helping them come to a conclusion about a problem they have. That seems to never have been your approach.
Yeah, I find it disconcerting when, like, you do a project and then you're doing press for it and inevitably the question comes up, so what did you learn from doing such and so? I never know how to respond to that.
It's not math class.
Yeah, I mean, I suppose I learned something. Like, if I'm playing George Jones, then I study about George Jones. I learned some things about George Jones. I learned a lot about George Jones. I don't necessarily hold on to all of it. I wouldn't claim to be the world's foremost expert on George Jones just because I played George Jones. But when I needed to know something, I tried to know it as well as I could. I feel, unfortunately, it's a lot like our educational system anyway. It's like you study for the final and you pass the final and then you forget whatever it was that you studied
in one year out there.
Pass the final, yeah.
Yeah. At that age, as a young actor finding his way, performing in these basements and strange small theaters, What were those quandaries that you were talking about? What were those things you were wrestling with?
Well, like, for example, the example I made earlier about that little play I did, Mr. Happiness, I think at that time I was very moved and worried about homelessness and homeless people in Chicago. I would reach out to them a lot. I tried to help them out, even if I didn't really have barely enough to take care of myself. I just couldn't walk by a homeless person without feeling really sad and wanting to help. So then I put that into this show, you know, this little presentation that I made. I saw an irony in somebody who had nothing and was like laying on this sidewalk next to a bag of garbage, trying to pretend to give advice to people that were complaining about their completely ordinary lives. So it's on a case-by-case basis, you know, everything. Like the zoo story, that was the other one. I was excited to do the zoo story with my buddy Dan because I had an idea that the way the zoo story should be done is that you shouldn't rehearse it. So I got Dan to agree to memorize all the lines separately from one another. I memorized mine, he memorized his, and then on opening night, the first night we did it, it was the first time we'd ever done it, which I later on in life got the opportunity to tell Edward Albee directly, because I met him in London, and he was mortified because I think he prefers people to rehearse his plays a great deal. But in our defense, it actually was one of the more successful ventures we had in the basement at Cafe Voltaire.
Mm.
It's funny, you mentioned performing in London, and my understanding is that you performed Killer Joe and Bug over there. Is that right?
Killer Joe and Bug. I also did a play called Wojciech by George Buchner.
When you took Killer Joe to New York in 1998,
yeah,
it's a play written by Tracy Letts.
Mm-hmm.
You did that at the Soho Playhouse, I think.
Mm-hmm, on Van Damme Street.
Where you had to perform 8 shows a week.
Mm.
How did you feel by the time the Sunday matinee show came around?
Yeah, you know, I did at least 400 performances at Killer Joe. Now, that's over several different productions and several years.
Heavy show.
Yeah, heavy, very physical show. You know, I mean, my character at the end of Killer Joe, I played Chris Smith in that. I was the original Chris Smith. If you've seen the movie version, it's the part that Emil Hirsch plays in the movie. But the end of that play is me getting savagely murdered. But it was less about stamina or endurance and more just about keeping it present and alive and not just going through the motions, you know. Because nobody wants to watch that. That's just dull as hell.
How did you manage to stay present?
Back then, I really relied heavily on music to get me in the right frame of mind. I listened to a lot of Grateful Dead during Killer Joe because I was playing a pothead drug dealer guy. The Radiohead was good for Bug because I was playing Peter Evans, who was conceivably a paranoid android. So, yeah. But when I was doing Bug, that's when the wheels really started to come off because Bug was probably the hardest thing I've ever done in terms of doing 8 shows a week.
When you say the wheels were coming off, what does that look like?
Well, when we were doing it in New York at Barrow Street Theater, we would do 2 shows on Saturday and 2 shows on Sunday. So after the Sunday matinee, I was really, I don't know, there'd be times where I just would think, I don't think I can do that again. I don't know how I'm going to do that again. It's like standing on the edge of a cliff and just looking like I can't go any further. There's no, but a lot of times people say those shows when you walk out on stage feeling like that, they can be something really incredible can happen when you get to that point of exhaustion. But no is not an option. You know, you can't just say I'm too tired and you just do it.
No is not an option.
Well, not in a situation like that. I mean, they sold the tickets. You got to go out there.
It's not George Jones.
Yeah. Well, that's, yeah. See, that's interesting. Yeah. That's what, again, what I found so fascinating about him is the, I don't know what that is, if it's courage or what, but to be able to say, you know what, I'm just not doing it.
But, you know, one person who did see one of those performances you're talking about is Tracy Letts, who wrote Bug and Killer Joe. And he said during the Killer Joe run, when I saw Michael, it was the first moment it was no longer like watching a dog on stage. You can't take your eyes off a dog on stage, but a dog doesn't necessarily help you tell good stories. I remember thinking, I can't do what he's doing right now. I don't know how to do that.
Tracy said it? Oh, wow. That's something.
What do you make of that?
Well, you know, I love Tracy. I give Tracy a lot of credit for my career in general, going all the way back to when I was 16. You know, he played my dad in a play, and he was only 25 at the time, but he's always looked a little older than that. So he played my dad, and he gave me these tremendous opportunities with these parts, with Killer Joe and Bug. That's how I went from the basement of Cafe Voltaire to where I am now, is basically those 2 plays, you know. But it was strange, like when the reviews came out for Killer Joe the first time we did it, I had never seen this. It inspired like animosity in the critics.
Mm-hmm.
Literally saying, this is wrong. They shouldn't be doing this. Mm-hmm. This is evil. That's why I say the dark arts, you know. And I was like, damn, you're really doing something. If you can get people, I mean, people ain't saying that when they go see like 2 for the Seesaw or Tally's Folly.
Or Harvey.
Yeah. So it's like a whole nother level. But I've watched Tracy act for years. I could argue the same thing, that he's, you know, he's definitely a legend in Chicago.
You seem almost surprised by that quote.
It's funny. I vaguely remember that quote, but for some reason when I heard it this time, it kind of hit me funny or something. It's uncomfortable, you know? I don't know, because here's the thing is, like, people are always asking me, have you ever thought about teaching acting? And I'm like, there is absolutely no way in hell that I could ever teach anybody how to act. I don't barely know how I do it myself. I mean, I don't know how you get into it. I don't know how you do it.
I don't know how to get out of it.
I don't know how to get out of it. I don't know. I don't know what to tell you. And I know that seems weird because I've been doing it for over 30 years, but it's God's honest truth. I swear to God, I'm not being disingenuous or false modest or whatever the hell. I just don't know.
I'd like to think you haven't been disingenuous throughout this whole conversation.
Yeah, well, that would be unfair to you.
The part that you think is uncomfortable, I guess I want to move from, because it's true, Tracy said that.
Yeah.
But it's also from that same performance that you got your first manager.
Oh, yeah.
Who told you to move out to Los Angeles and pursue this acting thing out here. What do you remember about all that now?
I remember it pretty well. I mean, I got a phone call. The part I don't remember is how this guy managed to call me or get my number, because I didn't have a phone. I'm on the phone with the guy. He says, look, I saw your play last night. I didn't want to go. I had a headache. Honestly, I don't love going to the theater. People kept telling me I had to go see it, and so I came to see it. And, well, I think you should come, and we should have a meeting because I'm a manager, and we should talk. I said, okay, sounds groovy to me. So I went and met him, and he was really just a larger-than-life, like, really, like, operatic type of personality. But I just loved him. Like, I was like, this guy's fascinating. I really like this guy. And then he said, I'm going to get you a job right now. You watch this. I'm going to get you a job right now. And he calls the casting director, and he says, hey, Laura, so I got this kid. I want him to come in for that thing tomorrow. He hangs up the phone. He's like, okay, here's the page. Go to this place, da-da-da-da-da. And I go, and it's Jesus' son. Laura Rosenthal cast Jesus' son. And I went and did that. And he said, see, I'm pretty good. He said, I'll get you another job. I'm like, all right. And so his partner at the time was Billy Hopkins, who was casting for John Waters, Cecil B. Demented. And so I went and read for that, and I got that job. And then I think Tigerland came after that, the Joel Schumacher thing. I was impressed. And he said, now, look, I want you to go to Los Angeles. And I said, I have no desire in going to Los Angeles. I like doing plays, and this has been exciting and everything. But moving to Los Angeles just makes me sad because I know a lot of people that have moved out there, and they're not happy. It's hard out there. It's really hard. And he's like, yeah, but you got me. He's like, I seem to know what I'm doing, don't I? And I'm like, I guess so. And so he talked me into it. And that was Lee Daniels, by the way. Lee Daniels, who's gone on to become a producer and a director and a creator of television and whatnot. But at the time, he was just a man. He was focused on managing. He had Wes Bentley, too. And I remember because I auditioned for American Beauty, but Wes wound up getting it. And anyway, so I went out to L.A., and there was a bar on 3rd Street called St. Nick's. It's not there anymore. It's something else now. But that was where all, like, the Chicago contingent would go and hang out. Tracy was living out here at the time as well, and he was in a little bungalow on 1st and Laurel, which was close by. So I was able to kind of have a little bit of a community. And then my friend Dan, the one I did the zoo story with, He came out, and we wound up being roommates. Yeah, and then, I don't know, Lee got me in some great auditions, you know? He got me in front of, next thing I know, I'm in front of Jerry Bruckheimer and Michael Bay, reading for Pearl Harbor, and everything kind of fell into place. Yeah.
You know, I'm thinking about this time in the early 2000s, where you're ping-ponging from storefront theater in Chicago to acting in, I think, 3 Jerry Bruckheimer films.
Mm-hmm.
And I wonder, heading into Revolutionary Road, where you play this mentally ill man named John Gibbings, Did you identify with this larger question at the center of the film, which is, do I be who I am, or do I have to try really hard to be someone else?
Well, that's an interesting question to ask an actor. I mean, it's basically my job to be somebody else. So, the way it all went down was like, so I'd been in LA for a couple of years, and it was the Pearl Harbor premiere, and it was in Hawaii, and they brought us all out there, and they put us up at the Four Seasons, and it was just about the fanciest damn thing you'd ever seen, you know, and I'm sitting there in this suite at the Four Seasons looking at the beautiful sunset and all this and drinking a Mai Tai or whatever. This director, Dexter Bullard, a Chicago director, whom I've known since I was a teenager, they were getting ready to do Bug at a Red Orchid Theater, the Chicago production. And they had just assumed, I had already done it in London. I had originated a role, but this was the Chicago premiere. And they just assumed I wouldn't come back and do it. So they had had auditions, and Dexter was calling me. He says, yeah, so I've narrowed it down to two people, Joe and Danny. I knew both Joe and Danny, and I knew exactly what he was up to when he called me. He's like, so what do you think, Mike? Do you think it's Joe or do you think it's Danny? And I'm just sitting there in this ridiculous hotel room.
My tie in hand.
And I'm like, Dexter, it's not Joe and it's not Danny. It's me. I'm coming back. So I, you know, turned my back on all that to go back and sweat in a little black box theater in Chicago for free. But thank God I did. I mean, I don't think I'm capable of like subjugating my impulses that way. This may sound like baloney, but I'm not a careerist. I never have been. I never set out to be like a movie star or whatever. And I don't have a production company. And I mean, I guess I kind of do with some buddies who wanted to start one, but I don't pay much attention to it. I just go where the wind, you know, I don't have like a list of parts I want to play or things I want to do.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't know if that really answers your question, but I guess what I'm saying is I got into this business, I think, or this work because I'm just a very restless person. It's funny, a really good friend of mine, somebody I had done a play with in the fall, he said the most remarkably observant thing. He says, when I'm on stage with you, it seems like you're trying to get free of something. And I thought, man, that's heavy. That's, I had never thought that before, but he could very well be right.
Let's say he is right.
Mm-hmm.
What do you think that is?
Myself, probably. It's the whole quiet desperation thing. I mean, aren't most people, you know, walking around kind of like, well, this could be more fun. I feel that way a lot of time.
Not right now or anything. It could be more fun.
No, I don't mind this.
If we had Mai Tais, it would be more fun.
Yeah, I wasn't going to say it.
I'll say it.
Do you know how to make them?
Very poorly. I wouldn't do that to you.
It's basically just rum and, isn't it? Rum and fruit juice.
Something like that.
Yeah. But, I don't know. I mean, I don't know the answer to that, what I'm trying to get free of. I guess it's just, maybe I'm kind of like a shark, you know? I just always want to be in motion.
We'll be right back with actor Michael Shannon.
The most innovative companies are going further with T-Mobile for Business. Tractor Supply trusts 5G solutions from T-Mobile. Together, they're connecting over 2,200 stores with 5G business internet and powering AI so team members can match shoppers with the products they need faster. This is enriching customer experience. This is Tractor Supply with T-Mobile for Business. Take your business further at tmobile.com/now.
Chase for Business and iHeart bring you a new podcast series called The Unshakeables. This one-of-a-kind series will shine the spotlight on small business owners like you who faced a do-or-die moment that ultimately made their business what it is today. Join hosts Ben Walter, CEO of Chase for Business, and Tanya Nebo, a lawyer and business consultant, on these storytelling journeys of trials, tribulations, and triumphs that hinged on a single event, a split-second decision, or even a stroke of luck. Whether the story is about a warehouse going up in flames or a former partner stealing a whole roster of clients, each episode will showcase the grit, determination, and resourcefulness a small business owner needed to turn a pivotal situation into a springboard for success. Listen to The Unshakeables now and learn more at chase.com/business/podcast. Chase, make more of what's yours. Chase mobile app is available for select mobile devices. Message and data rates may apply. JPMorgan Chase, NA member FDIC, 2024, JPMorgan Chase & Co.
This is it, your moment. This is your time to make your comeback with Purdue Global. When you come back with a Purdue Global degree, you create opportunity for yourself, your family, and your future. It's a degree you can be proud of, a degree that employers will trust and respect. Purdue Global offers working adults like you over 175 flexible degree programs to meet your specific career goals. These include associate, bachelor's, master's, and doctoral degrees and certificates. Purdue Global degree programs range from nursing to business to communication and more. Whatever your interest, we have the degree that will move you forward. You have the knowledge. You have the experience. Now it's time to get credit for the work you've done and earn the recognition you deserve with Purdue Global. Purdue's online university for working adults. You know you're worth it. We do too. So don't wait another second to get the degree that will take your career to the next level. Start your comeback today at purdueglobal.edu.
Coming back, that same year we're talking about, 2008.
Mm-hmm.
Believe your father passes away that year?
Oh, yeah, that was a humdinger, 2008. Well, I had my first kid in June, and then my father passed away in November, and then Revolutionary Road came out, and they're like, you're going to campaign for an award. I said, what the hell? What are you talking about? We're going to hire a publicist and everything. I'm still with her, Brenna. She might be listening.
You said once that year restructured your nervous system.
Mm.
What did that look like?
Well, having a kid does that, I think, intrinsically, because prior to having children, you really are, at the very least, entirely capable of only thinking about yourself constantly. And that's fine. Like, that's human nature, whatever. But then you have a kid, there is suddenly somebody who is more important than you are, like, in a deep sense of like, oh, I am no longer the most important thing. And then when I lost my dad, my relationship with my dad had been very interesting because basically the older my dad got, the closer I got to him. Like when I was a kid, I didn't even spend that much time with my dad until I started living with him. And when I was a kid, he was not a particularly easy person to get along with. But as I got older and he kind of mellowed out and started figuring out some of his deal, you know, and being easier to hang out with, we actually got really, really close. And he really helped me a lot in my life. And so losing him was, I don't know, this juxtaposition of a new life coming in the world and then this life leaving. To have that celebration and that grief right on top of each other, just, it was a little discombobulating, I guess. And then the third part of it, like really going to a new level of beyond just like, you know, getting the random part and this, that, or the other to like, oh, you're really going to, we're going to try and draw you into the, you know, the inner sanctum here, you know, get you nominated for an award, which, you know, it's a real establishment thing. It's like not really what I'm about. There's something really ironic, honestly, about getting nominated for an Academy Award, because if the actual John Giving saw that happen, he'd be like, well, that's horseshit. This guy's an idiot. And then these awards are stupid. But I was out there, you know, shaking hands and doing all the rest of it.
You know, I feel like you bring that whole year to the set of Take Shelter. It's a story where you play a mine engineer who kind of foresees the apocalypse, and he isn't quite sure if he's prescient or insane.
Mm-hmm.
You mentioned earlier as a performer, you dig deep into the subconscious and put that into the work. But in this role, Did the material itself hit closer to home for you as a new father?
Yeah, no, that's a very, very personal film for me. I mean, having that experience of fatherhood, actual fatherhood, because you know, it's interesting. I did this play called Lady by Craig Wright, and I literally did the play once in January before Sylvie was born, and then Sylvie was born, and then I did it in the fall after she was born, before my father passed away. And it was just incredible to me, the difference, because I was playing in the play, I was playing a father of, I think I had three kids in the play, and my wife is dying of cancer in the play. And the difference between doing it before Sylvie was born and after Sylvie was born was just really mind-blowing, because I just realized how hard I was pretending before, you know, because you just can't, it's something really hard to imagine, you know. So I had that. I took that in to Take Shelter, and I've always been very worried about the environment, and climate change is not a new thing. I don't want to proselytize here, but we've known about it for decades now. And I think you mentioned earlier that when I was canvassing for PIRG, Illinois PIRG, Public Interest Research Group, something that Nader started, I think. And I was going door to door saying, we need clean air, we need clean water. You know, unfortunately, you also are asking people for money, which sucks because it's hard to have much credibility when you're just ultimately asking people for money. But it was what I was passionate about and believed in. That was when I was a teenager. So, yeah, I had that very much going into Take Shelter. And then, yeah, a lot of it really lined up. I mean, even the relationship between Curtis and his mother was kind of similar to the relationship between me and my mother. And I'm not saying that my mother is not diagnosed as mentally ill or anything, but it just, that scene reminded me sometimes of how I interact with my mother. So it's kind of eerie, yeah.
You've called the film the most meaningful movie I've made.
Mm.
And I just want to sit with what I think is the most meaningful moment in the picture.
Okay.
It comes toward the end of the film after you've built this bomb shelter in your backyard to safeguard your wife and daughter.
Mm-hmm.
It's then that your wife, played by Jessica Chastain,
mm-hmm.
attempts to get you out of the bunker back into the world.
Mm-hmm.
Why don't we take a look?
You need to open the door now.
What if it's not over?
What?
What if it's not over?
It's over. Get the keys. Open the door.
It's still storming.
No, it's not.
Do you remember filming that day, filming that scene?
Oh, yeah. It's interesting you're bringing this up because most people ask me about the fish fry scene, but I'm assuming because you've done quite a bit of research, I can tell that you may perhaps know that that's actually my favorite scene in the movie. It's interesting. We shot everything in the bunker, like where we're actually with the door shut and we're underground. That was all actually a set that was built because the actual bunker that you see in the back is just is very small. It's so funny. Jeff and I were just talking about this the other day. I think we had like a day or maybe a day and a half to shoot all that stuff. And it was the last day of shooting and it had been an intense shoot and everybody was tired. And it was like I think it wound up being like a 18-hour day or something because we didn't have any more time. We had to finish that. That was it. So we just kept going. And I think we were all pretty tired and feeling a little sketchy. But something happened in that scene. I have to say, I give a lot of credit to Jessica, the way she played it. she struck some chord in my head or heart or something, and just something came out. But maybe that's what I'm trying to get free from.
What?
The bunker. That's something you got to get out of. It's so funny because I just finished, I don't know if it's funny, but I just finished making a movie, another movie that's actually set in a bunker called The End. When did I make Take Shelter? You know, right?
2011. So well, it came out in 2011.
It was 2023.
You know, when you're replaying that scene, both I think how it came out, but also the act of making it, It's the first time in our back and forth that I've seen you get emotional, to be like kind of at a loss for words. What do you think now that you're, I don't know, 12 years removed from that day with Jessica, what does it stir?
I don't know. I just think it's a fundamental thing that people struggle with, like being stuck inside of something, being afraid to leave or to go out or to change. It's very hard. I mean, in a way, we're all kind of are capable of being locked in a box or a bunker or something, locked in our own identities or sense of who we are, the routine, the habits of our lives, you know, to actually have the courage to leave that or to unlock the door. But also it moves me because, like I said earlier, there's so much care in it. I get very moved. Like a lot of times when something makes me sad, I don't necessarily get outwardly emotional about it. Because sadness is, I'm so accustomed to sadness that it's not that big a deal really. But a lot of times what really gets me is like acts of like kindness or consideration, or when people actually genuinely connect with one another, or when something really beautiful happens, that can really trip me up.
You know, I was thinking you were talking about being stuck in a place, and It seems to me that one way you got yourself out of feeling stuck is to kind of finally direct a film of your own.
Yeah.
Which I just watched last night.
Oh, you watched it?
I watched it.
Oh, cool.
You know, that question in Take Shelter is, how do you live in a world in which we live and not lose your mind?
Yeah.
How much of that question is embedded in this new film? How do you think this movie is kind of a reflection of where we're at in 2023?
Yeah. Well, the film's called Eric LaRue. Eric LaRue is a high school student who, unfortunately, commits a school shooting, shoots three of his classmates and kills them, and goes to prison. The movie is primarily about his mother, Janice, but also his father, Ron. But Janice, I would say, is the protagonist. She's played by Judy Greer. So this is all a little bit in the rear view. You know, Eric's already in prison and a few months have gone by, but Janice is still having a hard time figuring out how to live after what her son's done and what it says about her and who she is. And so I've been saying a lot, I think it's true, is my impulse to make this movie was born out of a realization I had about my feelings about being an American and living in this country. There's a lot I love about America. There's a lot I don't. And particularly during the whole debacle with Trump getting elected president, I was on the record as saying some pretty heated, vitriolic things.
You said people who voted for him could drop dead.
Yeah, basically. It's time for the urn, yes.
Yours is much more elegant.
Yeah. And then I entered another phase after that where I thought, you know, regardless of whether you love this country or hate this country, or you're happy or you're angry or whatever you are, I think it's hard not to agree on the fundamental concept or premise that it's just very confusing. It's a very confusing place that we live in. And I thought when I read this script, which was written by my friend, Brett Nevue, who's a playwright I've known for many, many years, that it really encapsulated that notion quite eloquently. And so that's what inspired me to direct it.
And now that you have, do you feel any less confused about this country?
Oh, well, I don't think it's for me to, I don't think I did it as any sort of catharsis. But I tell you what is interesting is I've finally gotten an opportunity to watch it with other people. And that is pretty mind-blowing experience. And I can see then now that it's finally kind of starting to get out into the world that it, I think it will make people think and talk, and I don't know. I guess that's pretty much all you can hope for.
When I finished watching the movie last night, it was maybe, 3 in the morning.
Oh, dear.
Tough movie to
end your day with.
Yeah. I mean, you don't fall asleep easily after that.
Yeah.
And I was thinking about the twists and turns your career has taken. And I know you said, I'm not a careerist. I don't think about plans, or I don't have a bucket list of whatever. But there's this moment in your life, once again, back to 2008. It's in April. You're performing The Little Flower of East Orange at the Public Theater.
Oh, yeah.
It was directed by the late Philip Seymour Hoffman.
Yep.
And there's a day in rehearsals that I just wanted to sit with as we go.
The play is set in a hospital. The main character, my mother, played by Ellen Burstyn, and she's in the hospital. So there's a hospital bed in the room. It's basically the only set we had. And I walk in, and Phil is laying in the hospital bed, and he's just laying there, totally still, expressionless, staring at the ceiling. And it's a little disconcerting. And I slowly walk over to him and I say, hey, Phil. And he's like, hey. I'm like, you all right? And he said, yeah. And then he said, you know, sometimes I just want to move away from New York and just go out, I don't know, to some middle of nowhere place, some little gas station on the side of the road or something, and just pump gas and nobody knows who I am and just be completely anonymous in the middle of nowhere. And I was like, oh boy, he's having a hard time. And then he turned and he looked at me and he said, you know, someday you're going to know what I'm talking about. And that kind of shot through me like a lightning bolt. And I said, okay. And then people started filing back in because lunch was over and we kept rehearsing. But yeah, geez.
I guess now that we're here,
mm-hmm.
Have you arrived at that day?
Oh, dear. I don't know.
I guess, do you know what he's talking about? And if so, have you arrived at a similar conclusion?
Yes, I know what he's talking about. I also think, and I really want to make this super clear, that Phil, by and large, was a very joyful person who really loved his work and loved the people he worked with and was very open. Because of that, sometimes he would, you know, speak a truth that was something like what I just said. But for the most part, that's not who he was. He was very just filled with love and light, and he gave us so much. One of the best directors I ever worked with. But yeah, there's a dark, obviously Phil has a dark side. I mean, dear Lord, he's not even with us anymore. So I do know what he's saying, but I also know that that's not a permanent feeling.
What is it?
It's just a feeling of just wanting to be unencumbered of the notion of, I don't know, that you're some genius actor or something. You know, everybody wanted Philip Seymour Hoffman to be in their movie. And then you're just getting buried under a mountain of scripts from all ends of the world. Everybody telling you, you know, oh, there's no way we can make this right without you.
Sounds like someone I'm talking to.
Yeah. Well, I'm not ready to say I've taken Phil's mantle just yet, but you know, you can also just say no. You don't have to go work at a gas station. You can just say, no, thank you, and just wait for things that seem to have some merit. Yeah.
You've done a whole lot of work in the last 10 years.
Mm-hmm.
You're now like an action figure that can be bought at Target. Mm-hmm. You have this new film. I suppose I just keep coming back to the same question, which is, what makes you keep wanting to do it? Do you still love doing it?
No, I still love doing it. Well, I just had this completely insane experience doing this movie that I was starting to talk about earlier called The End, which is a musical set in a bunker underground when the world is no longer habitable because of the effects of climate change. So it was like tailor-made for me. It has all my favorite stuff in it. And I worked with this fascinating director, Joshua Oppenheimer, and just the most exquisite cast. My wife was Tilda Swinton, for Christ's sake. It was hard. It was really hard. And we struggled a lot. And there were some times that, you know, we were like, Jesus, can't just get us out of here. But I'm really glad I did it. And I'm not saying it was easy or I always enjoyed it, but I think I've really got my fingers crossed that we might have made something really special and meaningful and something that the world needs to look at, which is how I feel about the Eric LaRue or Take Shelter, you know. And to me, it's worth the hardship or the struggle that it takes maybe to make it if it does actually have that kind of impact. Like, that's, I'll take that over like a big paycheck or even my own personal comfort. I guess that's what's always kind of motivated me.
Well, so long as this world is habitable, I'm grateful for the work you do, you've done, and will continue to do. I didn't come up with lyrics for you.
Okay. That's all right.
But maybe later I can figure that out.
Send me the one that you thought was nice earlier.
Yeah, we'll send you the audio.
Okay, cool.
Michael Shannon, a pleasure.
Thanks, Sam.
And that's our show. If you enjoyed this episode, be sure to leave us 5 stars on Spotify, Apple, wherever you do your listening. If you want to go above and beyond, sharing the show on social media, with a friend, leaving us an actual review on Apple, all of this is still the best way for new listeners to find the show. I want to give a special thanks this week to the team at Narrative PR, Showtime, and of course, our guest today, Michael Shannon. To learn more about him and his work, visit our show notes at talkeasypod.com. For more conversations with other great actors, I'd recommend our talks with Oscar Isaac, Michelle Williams, Tessa Thompson, Ethan Hawke, Matthew McConaughey, Cate Blanchett, and Pedro Pascal. To hear those and more Pushkin podcasts, listen on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you like to listen. You can also follow us on social media at TalkEasyPod. If you want to purchase one of our mugs, they come in cream or navy, or our vinyl record with the inimitable Fran Lebowitz, you can do so at talkeasypod.com/shop. That's talkeasypod.com/shop. As always,
Talk Easy is produced by Caroline Reebok. Our executive producer is Janixa Bravo. Our associate producer is Caitlin Dryden. Our research and production assistant is Paulina Suarez. Today's talk was edited by Caitlin Dryden and mixed by Andrew Vastola. Our assistant editors are Clarice Guevara and CJ Mitchell. Music by Dylan Peck. Illustrations by Krisha Shenoy. Photographs today are by Jenna Jones. Video and graphics by Ian Chang, Derek Gabrizak, Ian Jones, and Ethan Seneca. I also want to thank our team at Pushkin Industries, Justin Richmond, Julia Barton, John Schnars, Carrie Brody, David Glover, Heather Fain, Eric Sandler, Jordan McMillan, Isabella Navarez, Maya Koenig, Jason Gambrell, Justine Lang, Letal Molad, Malcolm Gladwell, and Jacob Weisberg. I'm Sam Fragoso. Thank you for listening to Talk Easy. I'll see you back here next week. Until then, stay safe and so long.
The tradition of breaking tradition continues with the return of the Unconventional Awards from T-Mobile for Business at Mobile World Congress. This is an event that celebrates innovators whose bold actions took their industries to new places. If that sounds like you and you're a T-Mobile for Business customer, enter today. If you win, you'll be publicly honored among some of the most influential leaders in industry, and me, I'll be there too. Enter now at tmobile.com/unconventionalawards. See you there.
If a new house is on your wish list in the next 5 years, grow your savings faster and experience your dreams with an Ohio Homebuyer Plus account from Kemba Financial Credit Union. A savings account specifically designed to save for a new home where you can earn 7% APY, a $500 matching bonus, and a $1,500 mortgage closing cost credit. Learn more at Kemba.org. Offer expires March 31st, 2025. APY equals annual percentage yield. Restrictions apply. NMLS 292230. Equal housing lender. Federally insured by NCUA.
Your new home journey starts at Fisher Homes, where everything is red, white, and new. Explore exclusive summer savings and start your journey by selecting your ideal home site and your dream community. Choose from a variety of expertly designed floor plans and bring your style to life at the Lifestyle Design Center. Are you looking for a quick move-in ready home instead? Fisher Homes has options for those too. Fill out a form to connect with a new home advisor at fisherhomes.com to get started today before the sun sets on summer savings.